Welcome to the Norris Group's Real Estate Radio Show. Hosted by author, investor, hard money lender, and real estate educator, Bruce Norris. Equipping California real estate professionals for tomorrow's challenges.
On Friday, October 19th, the Norris Group proudly presents its fifth annual award-winning event, I Survived Real Estate. An incredible lineup of industry experts joins Bruce Norris to discuss perplexing industry trends, head-scratching legislation, and opportunities emerging for real estate professionals. Proceeds for the event benefit Make-A-Wish and St. Jude's Children's Research Hospital. This event would not be possible without the generous help of the following platinum partners: Foreclosure Radar and Sean O'Toole, the San Diego Creative Real Estate Investors Association and President Bill Tan, Investors Workshops and President Sean Watkins and Angel Bronskiest, Invest Club for Women and Iris Veneration and Bobby Alexander, San Jose Real Estate Investors Association and Geraldine Berry, Fry Wiles, MVT Productions, and White House Catering. Learn more about the panel and how to attend at isurvivedrealestate.com.
Hi, thank you for joining us. My name is Bruce Norris, and our special guest today is E.J. Burke. E.J. is Vice Chairman of the Mortgage Bankers Association. He's an Executive Vice President and Group Head of KeyBank Real Estate Capital and Corporate Banking Services, a division of KeyBank N.A. Burke is one of five group heads in KeyCorp's corporate banking division with responsibilities for KeyBank's real estate capital, Key's treasury management services, international and foreign exchange services, custody services, and the financial institutions client segment. Before assuming responsibility for the entire capital line of business, Burke served as head of real estate capital for Key, where he was responsible for all off-balance sheet capital market activities, including mezzanine equity and commercial mortgage-backed securities. EJ, welcome to our show.
Thank you.
I mentioned that last part because I'm very fascinated by some of the things that I don't completely understand, and one of them is the term off-balance sheet. So tell me a little bit about what off-balance sheet means.
Well, in key bank parlance, if you will, when we make a loan and we retain the loan 100%, we consider that to be on balance sheet. So it's an 100% of the loan is considered as an asset.
Okay, like a
portfolio. And then we will have to fund that with a combination of equity and debt.
Okay.
Whereas off balance sheet would be something we sell.
Okay. So it's not something that's sort of put on the sidelines. I guess that was some of the things that I thought off-balance sheet was. It was some of the things that would say were problematic, where you have an off-balance sheet. That was kind of my take on it. You're saying that it's just a portfolio of business that's going to be sold to someplace in the market.
That's right.
Okay.
Well, but although sometimes when we sell something, we sell it without recourse, meaning we sold it, the buyer assumes all obligations, or sometimes we sell it with partial recourse, where if certain things aren't true, the buyer can come back to the bank for some type of limited indemnity.
That's actually probably one of the more important aspects of what's about to be decided under Dodd-Frank, isn't it?
That's correct. The Dodd-Frank has a number of rules related to securitization of all forms of assets, and probably some of the more contentious rules surround the residential real estate market, although there are some that affect commercial as well, in particular the risk retention rules.
While that's still up for decision, does that affect the comfort level of lenders as far as what they're willing to fund?
It certainly any uncertainty in the market hurts the flow of funds, if you will. And I would say today, on the residential side, we're seeing it's very difficult for borrowers to obtain mortgage financing. I think it has less to do with Dodd-Frank there than it does the issues that a lot of residential lenders are having with Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, FHA around mortgage repurchases.
Mm-hmm.
Down the road, When the final Dodd-Frank rules are finalized, there are really three areas that I think will you'll hear more and more about. The first is the term qualified mortgage.
Right.
And that is supposedly, if you're a mortgage lender and you lend money to an individual secured by a first mortgage on their home, and you don't meet the definition of a qualified mortgage, that borrower might be able to come back later on and say, I want the debt discharged. That is engendered quite a bit of debate within the industry and with our regulators and politicians, so on and so forth. The second area is a qualified residential mortgage, and that is a mortgage that if it meets certain rules or for certain tests, then the seller of that mortgage or securitizer does not have to retain any risk. Right now, Dodd-Frank requires both on the residential side and the commercial side that the lender retain at least 5% economic interest in the mortgage.
How different is that from the past?
Well, in the past, when a loan was securitized, the seller retained nothing.
Okay.
In fact, most sellers would sell a mortgage for something north of par. In other words, selling at a profit, would take the profit up front, and then a series of investors would bear the risk of whether that loan or loans would repay on its terms.
And just so happened in recent history, that's probably been more painful than anyone's ever expected.
Without question.
Now,
I don't think anyone alive today has experienced a period of time like we have really in any real estate cycle.
Yeah, this is industry-wide, this has been a Great Depression. We managed to avoid it over in the overall economy, but our industry did not.
That is without question.
So when we have that type of an event, it seems natural to skew to the other side. And in a way, QRM, the way it originally was stated, would eliminate a very high percentage of people from borrowing for anywhere in the near future.
That's correct. I think when you think of QRM, there's a lot of conversation around minimum down payment.
Yeah.
And a lot of folks around the country believe that 20% is the correct number. But if you go look at, the number of people that can afford to put 20% down, it greatly constricts the number of people who would then be qualified to get a mortgage.
You know, it's interesting, and I mean, there's some very powerful people in powerful positions that have certainly stated that that would be the great solution. What do they do with the fact that a veteran, 90% of those loans are nothing down and is probably among the safest portfolio of loans for the last five decades?
Well, that's a really interesting question, and I know Mortgage Bankers Association has done a lot of research where they believe, or our association staff, who are fairly skilled economists and researchers, say that really it has more to, loan quality has more to do with income and job history, and a lot of veterans are fantastic employees, and have very stable wage earners, and that we think has more to do with predicting a default than the amount of down payment.
Dodd-Frank, when do those rules get established and finalized?
That's a good question also.
First of all, we don't even know what the rules are because we're making them as we go.
Right. I've lost track of how many rules the regulators are supposed to promulgate, but the legislation itself is very broad and delegates to the regulators, which in the United States, that means the Federal Reserve, the FDIC, the Office of the Comptroller of Currency, and FHA. So that means not only do you have to figure out the rules later on, but you have to have about, four or five groups that have to agree on them. As a result, almost all of the real estate-related Dodd-Frank regulations are way behind the deadline for agreeing on a rule, and that obviously pushes the implementation date back.
Well, I was kind of hoping that would be true, but I was afraid that maybe it wouldn't. In other words, we're going to implement something that isn't ready.
No, there will be a period of time once the rules are adopted that, you know, for an implementation period, and it's typically at a minimum a year, and in some cases 2 years. But in the case of the risk retention rules, they went out for comment almost 2 years ago, and given the incredible reaction from the industry and consumer groups, the regulators wisely said, well, maybe we need to reissue for comment the rules, and they still haven't done that yet.
Okay. Well, I'm glad they're listening.
Yes.
Sometimes I get the sense that I see people sometimes stand before Congress, and I can tell, you know, they've submitted a document to be read, and I, by the line of questioning, I can tell that no one's read the document, and it's frustrating.
Yes, yes. I would say recently we've noticed that members of Congress have paid a little more attention to what's going on with the rulemaking process, and have where they see, or where we've seen, the proposed rule kind of far afield from the congressional intent. We have seen where certain members of Congress have written letters and said, "Hey, this isn't what we really envisioned."
Okay.
So I think from that perspective, it's that's encouraging, but the amount of time that it has taken is discouraging.
The Mortgage Bankers Association has a very big annual meeting late in October, and I'd have to think that that's got to be one of the most important meetings ever, because 2013 could be fraught with a lot of changes for our industry. Things that we've assumed would always be there are certainly up for grabs.
Absolutely. I think in particular, if you think about housing reform, our entire finance system is up for grabs today. You know, there are, depending on your political persuasion, you might say that, we want to do away with all government role in housing finance, which would mean the end of Fannie and Freddie and FHA, which today provide, you know, over 90% of the of the financing that Americans come to rely on. That is up for debate.
What's interesting, they're probably writing the best book of business ever in history right at the moment.
Absolutely. You're exactly right. You know, and part of that is, if you think about it, it's not necessarily a good thing, in the sense that lenders are so scared and nervous about having to repurchase mortgages. They're taking the minimum rules that each of those agencies promulgate, and then they're overlaying against that additional underwriting, additional requirements. And what that means is that many home buyers get shut out.
What's interesting, that term overlay, we interviewed someone from FHA, and I asked them, what is their policy on loaning to somebody that's had a bankruptcy or foreclosure? And I fully expected to hear 2 to 3 years, and I heard 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
And I was, okay, because the overlay is very different. It's 3 years.
Right.
And so that's had a pretty profound effect over the last 3 years. We were pretty aggressive foreclosing in 08 and 09, and those people definitely went on the sidelines. I think what's interesting is that those people now are emerging as capable buyers again after 3 years on the sidelines, and they're meeting with virtually nothing for sale in our California. So it's very interesting. We have gone from 6 months to 1 month of inventory, and we're having price increases because of that. So it's just an interesting combination that's starting to occur in California's market. And that's, I guess that's one of the problems with creating national policies is that there's only probably six states that are like California, where foreclosures have been such a dominant piece of inventory. If you're in one of the other 44 states, you're probably going, what's the big deal?
I think that's true. There are, I'm based in Ohio, and much different economy, and there's plenty of inventory here in Ohio.
Yeah.
I think the other thing about California that you are experiencing is you were among the first to go into this. You were among the first states to experience. You were at the front end of the cycle, so. A lot of the new home construction stopped.
Sure.
A lot sooner in California,
mm-hmm.
and a lot of lenders exited, so as a result, you're now, I'm sure your multifamily owners are quite happy today because their rents are rising and their occupancies are at all time highs.
What's very interesting about the residential market, and then for the first time we have Wall Street multi-billion-dollar players buying houses.
Mm-hmm.
So we've never had that before, where there's a company basically that is interested in buying thousands of homes to become rentals. So that's a dynamic we haven't experienced before. So if you're a owner-occupant trying to get financing, whoever's selling that property knows that's going to be a challenge. And then you have other offers that are all cash for the same price. It's tough to get a house.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. We have a number of real estate investment trusts and private equity funds that we bank and who have approached us and said, we really think that we want to own single family residential as a rental prop, as a rental investment.
Mm-hmm.
And we're building infrastructure to acquire and manage literally thousands of houses. So, we're feeling it on the other end that there is, I think, a strong movement to buy distressed single family residential. And going back to your earlier comment about the other 44 states, most people in America think, well, gee, there's so much inventory, isn't this a great thing?
Well,
but not true in California and some other places.
Well, the term shadow inventory has come to mean lots of different things. And the assumption was that the lenders have foreclosed on it and they're hiding it. That isn't true. Now, it is true that they never foreclosed on it. It's sort of churning in the background with the 40-some percent of foreclosures actually being over 2 years old for whatever reason. But recent policy shifts, I look at Fannie Mae's bulk sale of the properties, mm-hmm. FHA's bulk sale of notes. It doesn't look like many of these are going to hit pay dirt as far as bank REOs, and that looks like the intention change, actually.
I think that's very true. I think that you have a number of different factors at work here. You have all the issues around national servicing standards,
mm-hmm.
and the AG lawsuit, and so a lot of servicers are proceeding very cautiously and very slowly. And from what I can tell, there isn't a ton of pressure from Fannie Freddie, FHA, to push the servicers to go to foreclosure. There's a lot more pressure around try and work with homeowners and try to get people try to work through modifications. I think that's politically where most of the pressure is coming from.
Does that mean you expect that would change direction after the election?
That's another really good question. I think it depends a lot on, frankly, I think it depends on what happens in Congress. And this is my own personal belief. This is not a mortgage banker's or key bank belief, but I think if we see the kind of Tea Party extreme conservative wing pick up representation, yes, you will see. And Romney came out with his white paper and said, we want to accelerate foreclosures and clean out the market. So if you see that, if that's the end result of the election, I think you would see a pickup in foreclosures. Now, more than likely, we end up with a stalemate like we have today.
Mm-hmm.
And then we kind of bump along, and I think it'll take a lot longer to clear through the pipeline of problem loans that we have today.
Well, you know, it's interesting. If you do them one at a time, that does take a while. You start selling them for, you know, $5,000 at a whack. That takes care of it pretty fast.
Right, right. But, you know, and by the way, you know, Fannie and Freddie have started making money again. So that's another interesting thing is, you know, if they start, you know, fire selling a bunch of inventory, well, you know, at below their basis that they have it on their books for, you know, that destroys their profitability. So
they're retaining ownership or part ownership going forward. So I don't know how, you know, that's in my mind, that off balance comment. I always think of, okay, well, we sold it, but we sort of didn't. We have half interest going on the upside. So it's really...
Yeah, I don't think the accounting rules will let you record that as an asset, but I get where you're going. And of course, there's never really been any history of how much that will tell us how much they'll actually realize from that.
You know, what's kind of interesting, we're down to about 2.5 minutes, is that the United States is just, at least in my lifetime and probably couple decades before that, is just always assumed that a 30-year mortgage is normal, fixed rates are normal. If you look at the world financing, that's not normal at all.
That's correct.
It's very short. It's much shorter, and it's almost always variable.
Mm-hmm.
And in a way, I try to think of the benefits. We've got this ridiculous interest rate. I became an investor in properties in 1981 and refinanced my house at 17.5% to become one. And now to have a mortgage rate below 4% is kind of shocking. But the positive ramifications of having $10 trillion of debt at 4% have to bode well for an economy versus somebody that's got whatever percentage of their debt in a variable position. That's going to take a lot more of owners' money at some point, and ours will be pretty fixed at a very low rate.
That's correct, but you have to think about the investor side of that too. I think there are a lot of pension plans that are who would normally be buying investments that are returning, you know, something in the 8% range, that are now looking at their investment horizon and saying, "How in the world am I going to make that? How am I going to make enough money to pay my retirees?"
So, okay, so that's a very valid point, because the projection is very necessarily at 8% or 7 or whatever, like CalPERS, and last year they got 1.
Right. I think our problem is that, you know, you have two sides. You know, every transaction has two sides, right?
That's right.
and we look at it and say, gee whiz, you know, if we can refinance, you know, the bulk of the home mortgages at these very low interest rates, we're putting all this money in the pockets of homeowners. But then there's the investment side of that, and the bulk of, and then the impact it has on retirees is just devastating.
Well, EJ, we've run out of time pretty much. I'm really looking forward to you being on this panel. You're going to be joined by a lot of experts in their category as well, and you'll add just a very experienced and valuable piece. We'll get to talk about mortgage-backed securities and commercial real estate, which has not
Great.
Usually been on the topic, so that'll be a lot of fun. So
Great.
We've been speaking with EJ Burke, Vice Chairman of the Mortgage Bankers Association, and we'll see him again in October. Thanks again.
We'll talk to you then.
You've been listening to the Norris Group Real Estate Radio Show. For more information on the Norris Group, please visit www.thenorrisgroup.com.
The Norris Group would like to thank its gold sponsors for supporting I Survived Real Estate, Adrenaline Athletics, Caldwell Banker Pioneer Real Estate, Elite Auctions, FIBI for Home Investors by Investors, Inland Empire Investors Forum, Inland Valley Association of Realtors, Investor Experts Incorporated, Keller Williams of Corona, Keystone CPA, Las Brisas Escrow, Mike Cantu, Northern California Real Estate Investors Association, Northern San Diego Real Estate Investors Association, Personal Real Estate Magazine, Realty 411 Magazine, Rick and Leanne Rossiter, Southwest Riverside County Board of Realtors, Stars Photography, UDirect IRA, Wilson Investment Properties, Tony Alvarez, Weston South Coast Plaza. See isurvivedrealestate.com for more on the event and all of the I Survived Real Estate sponsors.